Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia. This is PPTS, presented as a service to the progressive community by the Coffee Party USA Radio Network. PPTS highlights the activities, activists, and activism of the progressive movement. Join our host and special guests as we discuss the most interesting and important topics of the day. If you have a cause, an issue, a campaign, or candidacy that you're actively engaged with, please feel free to give us a call at 646-929-2495 and share with us your question or comment. Join the show's co-host and producer, Progressive Patty, in our lively chat. Go to the bottom of this episode page, sign into the chat room, and let us know what you are doing about it. All opinions are welcome. For the Coffee Party USA and Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, welcome to today's show. Please make welcome our host and friend, the Tennessee Progressive.
Hello, neighbor. Come on up. Sit on the porch a while. It's a balmy day here, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia, Tennessee on this first day of December 2013. We're very glad you're with us, and I'm very pleased and honored that you would spend some time with us today as we discuss some important issues in the world. We're joined with our show's producer and co-host, Progressive Patty, who is in our chat room. You can join our chat room by going to the bottom of the episode page that you click to listen to this show. You'll see the chat room there, and we have some guests already, so welcome to our guests. It's been an interesting week in politics and the political world, and it would take more time than we have on the show to give an honest recap of what's been going on. I would tell you that if there are 800,000 of you that would like to sign on to healthcare.gov today to enroll or to check out the options and premium prices and programs where you live for the Affordable Care Act, then you can do that. All you have to do is go to healthcare.gov. If you have any problems, please report them in the chat room or call us live at area code 646-929-2495. If you don't have a problem and you get signed up, call us at area code 646-929-2495. The site is currently up and running, and it's metrics are showing that it can handle up to 50,000 simultaneous calls. So you shouldn't have problems. It may be busy. And if it's busy, you'll be put into a queue for an immediate callback when the space is available for you to sign on via email. So by the time you enter your personal information, please include a valid working email. You can also call the help center that you'll find on the healthcare.gov site, and someone will help walk you through the requirements. It takes about 10 minutes until you are looking at plans and selecting them. And again, if you have any problems, please let us know here. You can say it's good or bad or whatever you think of it, but be sure that you've been there, okay? Don't believe the press you're hearing, because the press is in an all-out blitz against the Affordable Care Act. I want to remind you that it's called the Patient Protections and Affordable Care Act, and I'll be referring to it on this show as PPACA or the ACA. PPACA is Patient Protections and Affordable Care Act. ACA is the Affordable Care Act, previously known as Obamacare. It's amazing how many people you can interview and ask them about the Affordable Care Act. They like it. Ask them about Obamacare, and they hate it.
Hello.
So it's very important that we understand that this is going to roll out on January 1st, 2014, and it's going to roll out in a bit of a more complete format. We're being told that the rollout has been good so far, and that we're getting positive stories from across the inner tubes from people who have been on the Gov site, the website, and have had positive results. And we've had a few stories of people who are not seeing plan programs that allow them to lower their premiums or increase their benefits, yet especially in California. California has its own healthcare exchange, but they're adding programs and changing programs minute by minute. So if you found out that thus far you may find an increase in your benefits, but you'll have to pay a significantly higher premium, you have until December 23rd to look at that website before you choose your selection for your insurance. And there are programs that are going to be added and subtracted to that program, even in California, between now and the 23rd of December. Every state has at least one, what they call, middle tier of plans. And most states have several plans that are middle tier. Bronze, silver, gold, titanium, platinum, beryllium, americanium, laurentium, whatever they are. And you will be able to go to those sites and check those plans daily, hourly. You can also call the helpline number, and they may give you information on a plan that you can't see yet because it's still in the process of being loaded into the system. Now, there's going to be several hundred thousand people in California that are not going to be able to have a qualified policy the high-end expectation was about 900,000 people, but we're seeing that reduced even now. And we hope that by the 23rd of December, when all the plans are in, that everything will be fine. We're looking for reports from states. So if you have any state information as to your exchange or your part of the federal website, the federal exchange, please call us at 646-929-2495. We have a lot of written information from people who have participated in the exchange so far, and I'm excited to tell you that most people, in fact, I've only seen one negative, which is what I just reported on, and that's in California, where one person is having a trouble getting a premium. I'm sorry, they can get a health insurance program without a significant increase in their premium for the same benefits. There is as I say, a lot going on. For the vast majority of users, the system's working fine. They will continue to be working and improving and enhancing the website. And I want you to try it. If you have Medicaid or Medicare, I want you to try it. If you have spousal insurance, I want you to try it. Because there's absolutely nothing negative that can come from you going and looking at the price of insurance, health care insurance, where you live. It is true that most states have more than one series of metal plans that you can look at. You can compare. You know, apples to apples. Okay? And if you've received a cancellation letter, but they've advised you that you could, in fact, get equal or better coverage for a lesser premium with benefits that you like, that are qualified plans, then you should seriously consider. People have already gotten their first payments made and received and verified by their insurance carriers. And the more you know about the reality of the Affordable Care Act, the better off you're going to be. Unfortunately, you're not going to find out a lot about that from mainstream media. There is a full court press going on by lobbyists in Congress, especially during these days, to decry the healthcare.gov site and the program itself. They want to repeal Obamacare. Well, okay. If you don't have a superior product to replace it, your repeal efforts are going to fail. And I don't know how it's going to be possible for you to have a better plan or a better program to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act with the patient protections that are already in it and have been in place for some time. Now, the purpose of this show is to talk about the war on the poor. This is very definitely a part of that war. And it's unfortunate, but we will at least report the facts. And if you have information or want to continue with the conversation live on our air, give us a call at area code 646-929-2495. There's a lot in this war on the poor that we have had to get our fingers on to try and understand what exactly is going on when it regards the war on the poor. As a result of that reality, we here at PPTS and the Coffee Party have chosen 8 areas. 8 different battlefields that we believe are actively engaged in the war on the poor. For the last 3 weeks, we talked about the first of those. And in the war on the poor, there are large numbers of people that suffer today in a very special way when it comes to hunger. And we talked about that for about 3 weeks. And we talked about the hunger cliff, what it is, what it means, who is going over the hunger cliff, who is hanging on to the ledge to keep from falling down the hunger cliff, who is pushing us toward the hunger cliff, and why. We began a conversation that we want to continue regarding the hunger cliff and the war on hunger. I've got to use my own terms. It's the battle of hunger in the war on the poor, which is why it gets a little confusing. Well, today we're going to begin to look at a second battlefield, and that is the battle for education. It's really interesting to call it a battle as it relates to the war on the poor, because what we're talking about is education in the United States of America in 2013. Public, private, charter, magnet, adult, college, prison, the whole deal. This is a huge topic, and we will not do it justice in the short time we have. But we're going to try. What we want to do is to give you a sense, just a sense, of what's going on in the battle for education. We've got to talk about students. We've got to talk about public schools. We've got to talk about charter schools and magnet schools, alternative schools, adult schools, secondary education, college, teachers, parents, students, administrators, the politics of education. And it's going to be a very large subject, okay? I want you to know that going in. So when you hear me talking about this, please understand that I may not be giving reference to precise facts in your state, but over the course of getting through this battle or understanding what the battle is, that will lead you to further information. Remember that I said in the very first that from my standpoint as a Tennessee progressive, I'm looking at this war as a commanding general of the defenders from the onslaught and the attack of each battle. I see it as one war. And the war is going to take place on a very large battlefield. But there are multiple battles going on. And it's my responsibility as the commanding general to understand each of those battles so that I can effectively, if you will, resource appropriate troops to that battle in this war. And that comes through information. So if you'll hang on with the military alliterations for a while, we'll get to it. And I thank you. Again, you're invited to call 646-929-2495. We love to hear from you, and we'd really like to make a lot of this show about you. So you can join us in our chat room. You can call in. You can listen to us on archive, and this show will be replayed this coming Tuesday beginning at 9 p.m. Pacific time with our friends at netrootsradio.com. You can always archive, listen to an archive of the show here at blogtalkradio.com/coffeepartyusa, one word, coffeepartyusa. And we are very pleased to have Progressive Politics Tennessee Style as the newest addition to the Coffee Party USA radio network. We have a now long-standing relationship with Netroots Radio. I host a show there, and we replay this show as a courtesy from Netroots Radio as a part of their air. And you will hear possibly more shows from Netroots Radio in the future. We'll hear over a course of time, short time, you'll hear from all the hosts of Coffee Party radio shows. and Coffee Party officials who want to talk with us about things and will participate in our conversations here as well. So if you want to give us your read on the education battle, please feel free to do so. You can email us at one word, the Tennessee Progressive at gmail.com, and we'll respond to your emails. I want you to know that we're accessible. I want you to know that we're interested and that you are valued here, not only as listeners and callers and chatters, but also I know that there are a large number of Coffee Party members who are listening to today's show or will listen to it in the next 24 hours. And we don't want yours to be an isolated incident unless you choose it to be so. But even with our archived messages, you need to be able to contact me or the show and let us know what you think about what we're talking about. We participate with two rules. The first one is play nice. One of the tag landmarks of the Coffee Party is what we call the civility pledge. You can go to coffeepartyusa.com and just read about the Coffee Party. Read the civility pledge and understand that that's how we choose to do things here. Play nice. Be respectful. You're in my house. You're a guest in my house. And if you can say it in front of your grandmother's pastor in his living room, you probably can say it on our airwaves. Okay? The second rule is come prepared. Now that means this. If you have an opinion about how you think something is or should be, put a big box around, state it as your opinion, and you're good to go. We may challenge you on that opinion because we want to know where you were informed or how you arrived at that opinion. We'll ask you questions about that. If you want to present a fact or a series of facts, please come prepared. Tell us where your links are and let me see where you're getting your determinations from. I'll give you mine. I can tell you right now that most of the facts you're going to hear today come from basically one site, and that's the National Center for Education Statistics. Okay? And it's at nces.ed.gov. I'll put that in the chat room. And you can follow along. You can use it later. You can find out. That's the fun part. You can find out exactly what's going on. One of the things we try to provide our chatters are the facts that we use. Now, the website is now in the chat room. You need to know that the chat room is not archived and that we will attempt to post in our after show blog over at dailycoast.com/PPTS the links and a wrap up to each show. We have a group over at thedailycoast.com called PPTS, and we get information, input, feedback, and conversation all the time from the more than 1 million members of that organization. We look forward to yours as well. You can reach us on the Coffee Party show site. We'll have a blog there shortly. And we'll be doing prep blogs over there. How we prepare for the show. Who we're going to anticipate having a special guest or what the topic is. And how you can participate. That's a lot of information that is all about communication. So if you have a question about that or you want to call us, Call us at area code 646-929-2495, and we'll find out a name and your issue, comment, or question, and we'll put you on our airwaves. Okay? Let's go to work. Is it the responsibility of government to provide, administrate, legislate, create, maintain education in America? If so, what should that look like? Who should be involved? And who should be the recipient of the benefits of that work? Your tax dollars or your private money? Now, when I'm talking about tax dollars, I'm talking about dollars that you pay to the federal government each year in your federal income tax. At the federal level, there's no additional fee charged for public education in the United States. Public education in the United States is basically free. Over the course of the last two decades, programs have been cut, teachers have been cut, schools have been either consolidated or closed in the name of financing education. Is that a responsibility of the United States government? Well, an awful lot of people think it is. In fact, one of the platforms of the Democratic Party and the platform plank under which the current president ran in both 2008 and 2012 was a robust public education system in America. Now, there are some programs within the administration that a lot of people don't care for. Core curriculum is one of them. This involves administrators, teachers, students, and parents, districts, and states. There have been, in the past 25 years, a number of educationally related programs, projects, panels dealing with public education in America. In the previous administration, there was a program that was known as No Child Left Behind. It was, among other things, a dismal failure. It was an ill-conceived notion because it was from the top down. The administration dictated to school districts, teachers, and parents what they would or would not, could or could not do. It also relied on standardized testing as a means evaluation of success. The trouble was the standard changed from school to school, but everything was about the test, and we wound up with teachers teaching students to prepare for a test instead of going to learn. Now, in the battle on hunger, we talked about some of the aspects of hunger that affect education. And it is a very real fact that when children go to school hungry, they are not prepared to learn. Now, this is not the student that rushes out of the house because he wakes up late. This is the student that does not have breakfast at home because breakfast is not available to them at home. And a lot of parents who are finding themselves in severe financial crisis often are left with nothing more than the dependence upon public schools to feed their children. Depending on your income, there's a sliding scale that goes all the way down to zero cost or a minimal cost per meal in each school. Most schools today have cards that students use. It's a part of their school ID card, or actually forms the basis of their school identification card, which allows them to charge their meals as they go through the line. Parents pay to recharge their cards when the cards get low. Most schools send an email to the parent, which means that if you're in public school, your parents have to have a valid email. A lot of them don't, because a lot of school students who need this program don't have access to the internet because they live in shelters or they live in cars or they live in places where the luxury of the internet is simply not a luxury they can afford. So parents who don't respond to an email within a certain amount of time get a phone call, which means that a parent has to have a working phone number. And in many instances, that's not possible because it's a luxury that these people cannot afford. And in 20 years, we've gone from computerized technology that has been traditionally a bauble to a necessary part of our daily existence. It is a component fundamental of our society. Now, we may not appreciate that and we may not like it, but it happens to be true. And the internet's not going to get smaller. It's only going to get larger. As approximately 100 million people start a new web page every day, there are over 1 billion hits per month on the internet today. If you don't have access to the internet, that entire universe is cut off from you. There are people like me who spend entirely too much time doing too many things on the internet. I write on the internet. I teach on the internet. I have multimedia presentations on the internet, from radio and television or video webcam to writing to PowerPoint presentations to written words that take up a lot of my time, too much of my time. Yet I'm on the internet for a purpose that is my vocation these days. I am on the internet because that's where my work is. And my work is communication, education, information, collaborative with people I don't know and will probably never meet. But I think that what I have to offer is so necessary, so needed, and so important in these days that I unretired from the political life, got back involved in politics, and my world blew up. I've been a radio host now on these shows for over almost 2 years, I think. It'll be 2 years in March. And so that's 1.75 years. The reason I can do that, see, I just translated one unit of measure into a different unit of measure because I have a basic understanding of mathematics. You need to know that I am not a spring chicken. And one of the things that I do on the internet is I am consistently enrolled in courses, not the ones I teach, but ones that I find interesting or find useful or I find bringing me to a new level of understanding about the technology that we're using or business or name it. There is a growing percentage of American citizens and citizens from around the world, and this is one of the places where you'll really see a global community. and education. And it's education at the elementary, well, preschool, elementary, secondary, and post-secondary adult learning environments. Most schools have at least one course where every student in the class has access to a laptop computer. There are programs out there that will make sure that every student in every home has a laptop computer. Of course, you got to have internet access. Sometimes that's difficult. I've had friends that didn't even, you know, since I've been living in Tennessee, that don't have internet access. And they can't participate in some of the opportunities that are available to them because they cannot afford internet access. When education is diminished, withheld, because you cannot afford internet access, you have just entered the battlefield that is called the battle for education. Now, if a university enrolls a student and provides them with a Mac iPad or a tablet PC or whatever they're giving out these days, and that student does not have internet access, they have to find it. And what they do is they look for a spot that has what's called Wi-Fi. Okay? And Wi-Fi allows you to wirelessly, without having hard wires in your computer, find the internet. One of the places that a lot of people use is McDonald's, for instance, who is 100% Wi-Fi. If you go to a McDonald's, you can, if you have a laptop, you can get on the internet. If you're traveling and you're in a motel or a hotel, it's virtually standard that they will have internet access. Hospitals. Of course, schools. That means everything from primary schools to universities. There's a lot of places in every single community with a zip code where access is possible. It may not be great. There's a reasonable percentage of America that is still on what's called dial-up, and it's not on broadband or DSL. And if you don't understand any of these terms, let us know. Give us a call at 646-929-2495. We'll talk about it. One of the problems with the battle on education is the same as every other problem that we will encounter on these battlefields in the war on the poor. Definition. How is it that you can decry education because people can't afford it? I've just given you an example. Like, people can't afford meals. They can't afford access to the internet. They can't afford the additional charges that schools are putting on students to rent books, to pay for lockers, to participate in post-school activities, to extend or expand not only their social networks but their educational networks as well. When you combine that with other factors like hunger, teachers are having to fight some amazing challenges these days in getting their students prepared to learn and actively learning on a daily basis. If you don't have internet access in a school and you're like a junior high or a senior high school student, one of the things that means is that you have the basic responsibility to get all your homework done before you leave school. So there's an increase in study hall. There's a decrease in academic education. There's a decrease in extracurricular activities because you have to choose between being in the course or being in a study hall where you can get your homework done. One of the things that the internet has provided through education is an increase in societal pressure amongst peers in the educational system. That means teacher to teacher, administrator to administrator, student to student, and between them than has ever been the case in the history of education as we know it. on average, less than 20% of freshman college students are prepared to do those basic things that college requires of every student in order to have a hope of being successful enough to graduate and get to the starting line of the rest of their lives. These are things like basic mathematic functions. I'm not talking about algebra 2 and trig. I'm talking about 1 plus 1. Basic math. I'm talking about basic English. They cannot construct a proper sentence. They cannot write an effective paragraph. They have no idea how to fill out a resume or how to create a lifeline, a timeline of their life. They're really not certain about how to use these tools that they've kind of surfaced over in their pre-college learning. And as a result of that, an awful lot of the expense of college has been added by having to retrain these students in how to learn, what to learn, when to learn, and where to learn. The student brings the why. And the student that brings a strong why can overcome any of these challenges. When you talk about having the why, there's a host of reasons. But it stems from a love of learning and the goal of every teacher at every level of any education system I've known, whom I would consider to be a good teacher, instills the love of learning in their students. To make every learning opportunity an adventure. Now, I used to go to the library because I had a teacher tell me once when I was in elementary school that every book was an adventure and it was for you and it was inside the covers. All you had to do was sit down and open the cover and you would be off on an adventure. And it was invariably true. Even in advanced college courses, it was the same. There's something in here I came here to get, and I'm not leaving without it. I paid for this. I'm going to get my money's worth. I'm not going to settle for substandard teaching, and I'm not going to participate in substandard learning. Well, I learned that at a very, very early age. I learned it at home. It was reinforced in school, and it carried with me even to this very day. I'm enrolled in, I think, between 6 and 9 courses starting in the spring. I don't know. Why? Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. But you can count as the first of them my love of learning. If I'm not learning, I'm dying. I don't want to die. So I learn. I grow. I bring new facts and educational opportunities and information and interesting little tidbits to my radio shows. Or in my blogs, or wherever it is I'm communicating with others. One of the reasons that I decided to come out of retirement was because I love to learn, and there are things going on in my world today which dissatisfy me. So I wanted to learn about what those things were, how they came about, possible solutions, how to implement them, and how to measure the success of the implementation. Adjust, rescope it, do it again. Rescope, do it again. Evaluate, adjust, change, do it. Until the change is effected. And we've seen this time after time after time in areas of the battles, the 8 battlefields that are on the war on the poor. And things change. One person speaking truth to power creates change. But you got to speak truth. And in order to speak truth, you got to know the truth. Sometimes you don't know what the truth is, so you got to go research it. You got to find out how to find it. You got to understand. Well, you're taught to do that. Someone teaches you to do that. It may be a middle school teacher, an elementary or pre-K teacher. It could be a college professor. It could be an adult learning experience. It could be simply attending a meeting at your work. And you learn as you progress through the learning process and the learning cycle, the wisdom of the old Japanese saying that says, it's better to have men think you a fool than open your mouth and remove all doubt. That's another resource that I've held close to my chest for a very long time. A very long time. I believe it is in the very best interest of the United States of America to have an educated population. Believe it or not, there are many, many Americans who disagree with me on this point. I believe that the better educated our population is, the better America becomes. There are vast numbers of people who wholeheartedly disagree with me on this, who believe that you only need to be educated so far. After all, you're going to be tasked with minimum work for minimum pay in a job that requires little to no educational experience, no wisdom, no intellect. Untrained, low-wage labor. And interestingly enough, there is a correlation between the amount of education a person has and the wages they receive. One of the ways that you can help ensure that you will never have one of the jobs that these people propose for you is to be educated. And to be educated not only in the hard sciences and the curriculum of education itself, but in a specialty, hopefully a specialty that is your passion, something that you just dearly love, and would love to spend your life doing, even if they didn't pay you for it. So, what's your dream? What do you want to be when you grow up? There's an education for that. And it doesn't matter where you are in your educational process or your status. You know, I was a bad student. I was a lousy student. I was an absent student. I was a good student. I was a great student. I was a valedictorian. Doesn't matter. Does not matter. The question is, do you have or can you adopt a love for learning? If you can, there's a lot of people who are arrayed against you to make sure that you don't. The reason for that is because they don't need people who are educated. That is a threat to their employment. That is a threat to their jobs. That is a threat to their businesses. Educated employees tend to be thinkers. Thinkers tend to see justice and injustice, good and bad, truth and untruth. And a lot of people are not willing to settle for what other people tell them they should think, believe, or feel. They kind of like rebels. They like to be independent, you know. Well, independence can be a problem. And too much independence can be a big problem. And the more independent you are, the bigger the problem becomes, because then you have access to the truth and when you have access to the truth, you have a responsibility for the truth. Think about it a minute. You know, if you're not, let me use a term I hate. There's a difference between stupidity and ignorance. Okay. Ignorance is generally forgivable because it means there's something you don't know. There's an easy solution about that. Learn about what it is you don't know. Stupidity, on the other hand, is different. Stupidity says, yeah, I know that. I'm just not going to do it, or I'm not going to believe it, or I'm not going to like it, or I'm not going to agree with it. I don't care if it's a fact. Stupidity devolves into idiocy. Idiocy devolves into insanity. Insanity devolves into madness. It can affect an individual, a family, a community, a nation. A collective refusal to acknowledge fact is national stupidity. It is education which is the prescription to eliminate that stupidity. Question is, where are you in all that? Well, are you where you want to be? It's worthy of a little consideration because, first of all, you have to take this on an individual basis and say, you know what, I'm not doing as well as I could be doing in school. Stop right there. Because what's going to follow that is some kind of rationalization or justification that doesn't need to exist, okay? Anything that you put after that is a lie. I'm not doing well in school, but all after but's BS. The question is, do you have a desire to do better in school? A lot of people don't. A lot of people feel negatively towards school, that it's something they have to endure until a certain age when they can opt out. But they have absolutely no interest in being there whatsoever. This is not just a factor of poverty. This is not just a factor of inner city living or suburbia or anything else. Now, I don't mind if a student's very best is a C+ or a C-. But in my world, if you're a student capable of A+ and you come across with C-, because after all, that's average, you're going to have a real hard time in my world, I'll tell you that. If you're capable of A+ work, that is the minimum expectation for you. And it's no big deal if you get A+. That's what's expected. If you get A++, well, then you've got something going. If you're at the top of your game and your best is a B, that's success. If you get an A-, we're going to celebrate, probably in the streets. But you show up. You're in school every single day. You show up in every class. That teacher has something to give you today, and you're not leaving until you get it. And that's true if it's study hall or band or chorus or physics lab or cheerleading or the football team or anything else. If there's something for you to do there, there's a reason for it. Your job is to pare away like the levels of the layers of an onion until you get to the core of what you're supposed to take away that day. Now, I will tell you that education can be sneaky because sometimes the things you learn do not become visible to you for many years. We continue to learn, even those things which have been given to us years and years ago. We come to understand things in a way that we never understood them before. We do that in public schools, in private schools, in charter schools, in magnet schools, in adult schools, in online schools, in prison schools, because it's something inside of us. We try to find the very best opportunity to use that which is within us. That's because we love learning. We love it. And I've been learning and teaching for a very long time. And I love both to this day. I want you to love it too, and I want your children and grandchildren to love it. But I want you to understand something. True education is not free. It's not even cheap. We have teachers who must be paid, schools that must be built and maintained. We've got administrations to control, to give budgets, to create budgets, to expend budgets, to interface with the community. The school principal is the number one communicator to the community they serve. The school superintendent talks to the entire community for all the schools. The principal of a given school talks to the community for that school. His leadership of that school determined by how he communicates with the citizens whose children he teaches. And if she says, we're going to have a dress code at this school, and they go to the district superintendent, and the superintendent says, okay, go for it. I want a new computer lab. Okay, go for it. They're going to pay for it. Public school education has been cut as much, if not more, than any department, operation, or activity of the United States government in the last 20 years. Why? As I said, there's a large number of people who believe that we don't need educated people. What they generally tend to respond to that question with is, public education is too expensive, and we don't get the result. Well, I'm of a different mind, and I believe that I'm more aligned with many people in this country than those people. There is no better dollar spent than dollar spent in education when you talk about things that matter in the business world, like return on investment, projected outcome, and increased revenue. Virtually any metric you care to choose. Is education that can create the return of 100-to-1 ROI, return on investment. It is education that produces the tax base for your neighborhood and your community and your state and your nation. Because statistically, and I know that this is absolutely not universally true, but generally speaking, the more educational qualifications you have in a job, the more you will earn over the course of your lifetime. Now, we've got to talk to several million recent college graduates who have graduated college with a degree and have no job to go to. Why is that? Because, among other things, and there's a list of reasons in this battle on education, you've gotten your education. Now you have to go to work. Well, the work that you're qualified for is not available. And all of a sudden you find yourself competing with teenagers for a job at McDonald's. Because the one thing you did get from college was an amazing amount of debt. Because of the exorbitant price of education in America. Yet, There are those who believe that the government should not give a grant, a scholarship, a loan. You know, education's important, but it's only important to those who can afford it. If you can't afford it, you shouldn't be expected to have it. That is the core argument that we find on the battlefield for education. I received scholarships to go to school. I received awards to go to school. I worked when I went to school. I will never forget what I called the crazy year when I had 24 hours of college work and I was working a full-time job. I literally went to bed at a minimum 3 o'clock in the morning and got up at 6 o'clock every morning for a year, 7 days a week. Because I was bound and determined that my goals were going to be met. Nearly killed me. But I met my goal. I didn't feel the satisfaction I felt that I would have felt when I did that. Nevertheless, I did that. That's one of the values of education. It is where you can see some of your most important successes. Whether it's attempting a test in a subject you know little about, whether it's completing an examination for which you're sure you don't have the information you need because there was that party you did not, or mama needed the internet, or didn't have access to a library, or it costs too much. All of a sudden you begin weighing equivalents. You begin determining what the value is. There has been for a very, very long time in this country a truly amazing program. It's generally referred to as a baby policy. And what that means is, it's called Gerber Life these days, but you can purchase for a child, an infant or a child of any age, up to 18, a life insurance policy that serves many functions. If the tragedy of a child's death occurs, there's a payout. You don't have to be related to that child. It's better if you are, but you don't have to be. And you can purchase an insurance policy and make the parents of that child the owner of that policy and make the child the beneficiary of that policy. And they generally begin with $10,000 of insurance. It's term insurance, but cheap. Okay? A lot of people do a single pay, buy the whole policy at once. A lot of people go on a monthly withdrawal until the policy's paid for. And the policy has whole life value, which means that you can borrow against it in later years. Generally, at the age of 18, the policy doubles with no additional charge. It goes from $10,000 to $20,000. And that is the loan amount of the policy. It can go to $100,000 if you purchase additional units, and that's a time when the child becomes 21, I think it is, somewhere between 18 and 21, depending on the program you're using. The child can actually cash that policy out and receive all the value of the insurance that has been in that policy since they were born or whenever the policy was taken out. A lot of folks, especially in the 50s and the 40s and the 60s, took out these policies as a necessary matter of course of being a parent or a grandparent. My dad had these policies on each of his children. When it came time, what they call maturity, when the insurance policy matured and became paid, most Gerber Life policies have a wonderful little premium benefit, and that is that you can buy additional volume of insurance with no questions asked, no medical questions, no pre-existing conditions, no nothing. They say your policy has matured. You have the following options. Among them, you can apply and receive, for a price, additional insurance, and it's generally in $100,000 units. Okay? This becomes a whole life paid policy where you're the beneficiary, or you can assign the policy to another person to be the beneficiary if you're going to pay for the policy. Well, a lot of students cash these policies out and it bought them their first 2 years in school. Or, in the olden days, it would buy all their school. You could go as an undergraduate and finish an undergraduate degree with the payout from the life insurance policy that your parents paid from the time you were born. Now, that's not so true anymore, but it certainly is a value that can use to, say, fund a first year or the first 2 years of school, or at least help fund the first 2 years of school. Or pay toward a trade craft in a vocational school. Or you can sit there and let it grow. A lot of students I knew in my day used the policy for their graduation vacation. And you'd often hear my parents paid for this vacation. And they'd be in Cancun or Paris or, you know, someplace like that. That was how parents helped fund a child's education through college. I have friends who have told me that in their growing up, going to college was never an option. They were going to college. Education did not end at the eighth grade. It did not end with a high school graduation. It, matter of fact, probably didn't end with a college degree, but it would certainly go that far. I know in my own life, I couldn't wait to get to college. Biggest libraries I'd ever seen in my life, and everybody there was learning, and they had people standing by to say, I'm going to teach you now. I thought that was the coolest thing since sliced bread. Plato's Academia. I could be a part of it. I could learn whatever I wanted to learn. I knew what I wanted to learn, and I went there, and I learned it. There were programs that I paid a lot of money for. And one of them, the result was disappointing. The process was great. But it was my education, and I was always of the opinion, I was taught, that the education was my responsibility to myself. I don't think I'm particularly unique in that. Well, you can't go beyond high school because that's just beyond your expectations. You won't be able to survive college. You won't be good enough. You won't be there enough. A lot of students in high school that fail or nearly fail high school wildly succeed in college. Not every student that graduates high school should immediately go to college. They may not be of the maturity level that college requires as far as independent discipline and self-will. They may benefit by having a year or two of real-world experience. That means they go to a different country, they work a job, they, you know, get involved in the military and increase their college benefits. A lot of military people go into the military because of the educational benefits that they're supposed to get. Okay? That is all paid for by the military, which is an arm of the United States government under the Education Department. So, at every point in our lives, we see either the active pursuit of education or the results of education. It visits us all, every one of us. So, it's a real important issue for us to address. Why is there a war on education? That's always the first issue that we face. Why do you think there's a war on education? Do you think there is a war on education? If so, give us a call. We want to hear from you at area code 646-929-2495. Join us in our chat room. Let us know what you think about the topic today. Do you have a story? What's your education story? You can type it in our chat room. We'll respond on the air. If you want to, you can give us a call at 646-929-2495, and we'll listen to you tell your story. What does education mean to you? And why do you think there's a war on education, or do you disagree with the premise? Do you think there isn't a war on education? We have so many educational opportunities available to us that it's sometimes confusing when we try to determine. You need to understand that I don't know of many parents, but I have run into several parents who believe that education is not important. Some of it is historical, familial, cultural, societal, but they say, you know, what they get through grade school is fine. I need them on the farm. And the original education cycle included a break from school to plant the farm and a break from school to harvest the farm. And that's why we had what we called vacation. We had spring break, we had summer break, we had winter break. That was not accidental. And what we're going to follow up on as we go through this series is how those ideas and how those realities face themselves, how they become apparent to us as educators, and as parents, and even as students. What are the expectations for education that you live with? For yourself, for your children, for your parents, for your friends? And where do they find the education? Is a parochial school education better? Is a private school education better? Is a magnet school with a specialty in focusing on one area or other of education, like from the arts to tradecraft, better? What do you think? Because these are all options that are available and they're being competed for. There is an open war on education that finds itself steeped in a battle over public education. We're going to talk about that. And we'd really like to hear from you and know what your experience is, what your feelings are about it, because we're going to do a series of this for at least three shows. And what I'm doing today is trying to introduce to you the concept of the battle for education as it applies to the war on the poor. There are many direct correlations. There are a few indirect correlations, but the recipient of the information is the one who makes the difference. Because if you understand what this battle is, you can be prepared to defend it. You can make choices that are in your best interest as a parent or a student, and no parent I know of today is unaware of the fact that education is not free. question is, how much can you pay? Now, education is not only for those who can afford to pay, even though that is one of the main talking points of those who are engaged in the battle against education. They don't believe that education is a right. They don't believe that it's even in their own best interest to have an educated family. They worked in the mill. Their children are working in the mill. They don't need a lot of education. They get all the training they need at the job. The factory job is a whoops, wait a minute, hang on. We don't have any factory jobs. How'd that happen? We'll talk about that. And we'll talk about it even in terms of its application to the war on the poor and the battle of education. So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be proud to talk about it. Please stay with us. Consider your comments and questions. Chat room remains open during the break. And remember that you're listening to Progressive Politics Tennessee Style on the Coffee Party Network. I am the Tennessee Progressive. We'll be back in a bit.
Hello everyone, this is John Cashin, host of the Coffee Party Radio Civics Minute. Did you know that the Coffee Party is funded by our listeners and fans, and not by the super PACs, think tanks, or by a super wealthy individual wanting to buy the American way? The Coffee Party USA is powered by the people, and your passion to bring positive change to our country, but we need your help to continue. With just a small donation, you can help us continue bringing Americans together for a dialogue that attempts to bypass the normal partisan rhetoric that is so common today. The Coffee Party USA is striving to bring you original content from editorials, fact-checking, and video documentaries, while also working to bring you the latest information from all of the 535 congressional districts. No matter what party we may belong or what issues that we follow, one thing is always clear. We are all Americans. Please go to coffeepartyusa.nationbuilder.com/donate and donate what you can to help us move our country forward, united with one voice, e pluralis unum. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. This is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. There are many arguments proclaiming the evils of big government, and it always seems to come back to the same arguments made by the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists during the days of our founders, concerning the differences between a strong central government and a weak central government. The Second Continental College adopted the Articles of Confederation on November 15, 1777, and it was in place until 1789, but it was replaced by the Constitution, which advocated for a stronger central government. Why was it replaced? The Articles of Confederation maintained the principle that the national government would not hold more power than the states, that which they saw as sovereign. This satisfied the fears that many of the states had regarding a strong central power, as Britain was before the Declaration of Independence. In fact, there was no executive branch, because they feared giving one man that much power, and it was decided that the Congress would handle all the nation's affairs. However, there were many inherent weaknesses with the Articles of Confederation. The national government did not have the power to tax. Congress did not have the power to force states to obey its laws. Congress could not enforce laws. Each state could issue its own paper money. Any state could put tariffs on trade between other states or countries. There was no system of national courts. Congress could declare war and raise an army, but it could not force the states to give men or money. After the Revolutionary War, the country went into a deep post-war depression. The states were threatening war with each other, and there were armed uprisings and riots across the land. Things eventually got so bad that the country was on the verge of a civil war. This was called the critical period. Because each state was printing their own money, the value depreciated soon after the war, and many returning soldiers were paid in currency they considered to be worthless. There are stories that some soldiers wallpapered their house with the paper currency. On May 25, 1787, the Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia to decide the fate of the Articles of Confederation, and on September 17, 1787, a new constitution was approved, which had the much-needed, stronger central powers. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA Blog Talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
Welcome back to the Tennessee Progressive and Progressive Politics Tennessee Style. I am the Tennessee Progressive, and we're coming to you today live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia on this first day of December 2013. Where has the week, the month, the year gone? It has been a calendar flipping year, I'll tell you. We have been involved in a lot of things this year and a lot of things that continue. Today we're talking about the war on the poor, and we're talking about the battle for education. I wanted to highlight a comment that was made in our chat room by Nun 649. We're having a conversation about these battles, and Nunn says, there must be a war on education because we're losing, just like the war on drugs, the war on poverty, the war on homelessness. Those are true, and those are all areas that we're going to talk about in this battle, because if you're informed, you have an idea of what you can do against it. You can become the change you seek by speaking truth to power. And that's what we believe here at PPTS. That's certainly what the Coffee Party believes and extends. You're invited to the website of the Coffee Party at coffeepartyusa.com. Find out a little bit more about the Coffee Party, the issues that we stand for, how we intend to progress on issues that matter to us. And one of the things you'll find there is an amendment proposal to counteract the realities of life since Citizens United called the move to amend. And to amend the Constitution to say basically that corporations are not people and that money is not speech. There's currently an issue before the Supreme Court that they intend to rule on shortly about the second part of that. And that is that previously, as of right now, that is to say, back into the beginning of our history as a nation, corporations were limited in the amount of money they could expend in any given year on all campaigns combined. The court is trying to decide the issue of whether or not that remains true by dealing with a case called McCutcheon. And the premise of that case by the respondent is that they believe that corporations should not have limits on the total amount that they can give to any campaign or to all campaigns combined. We've been hearing about things from the false allegation that the IRS has been targeting specific groups of people to deny 501c4 status. There was a pretty big congressional hearing by Representative Daryl Issa's leadership, which tried to decimate the concept into a war. And after 40-some days of hearings, they found that there was no such thing as targeted intervention by the Internal Revenue Service on any group. In fact, there were several Tea Party and Republican promotional groups that had identified themselves as 501c3s that wanted to become or add to their inventory of 501c4, which is purely, incidentally, an educational organization. But 501c3s and c4s are not allowed to participate in political campaigns. And a lot of them have. McCutcheon says, not only have we, but we should be allowed to participate more. And we believe that there's a problem with that. That is so important that the Coffee Party was in large part established for one purpose. Now, the purposes have grown and expanded as we have been led into the more important general issues like education. But there is an amendment that is being proposed that would basically nullify the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United v. FTC that would say that corporations are not people and money is not speech. It says nothing else. That's it. That's the whole amendment. And we would like you to be on board with us on that or talk to us about that because it has a direct effect on education in America. How so? Well, there's a couple of ways that I can highlight as a topical hitter. The first is that for every year in the last 22 years, public education entities from pre-K through post-grad have seen reductions in their budgets, both federal and state. Education is the hopper that states tend to take money out of to balance their budgets. And they do that by reducing the amount of money that they're committing to education in their state and keeping it in the general fund to pay for other things. local municipalities have it a little bit differently, because when they establish educational budgets, it's usually based upon taxes that their citizens pay, primarily through property taxes. A portion of those property taxes are given to education of the school in the neighborhood and the communities where they live. A lot of people say, I don't have kids in school, why should I pay for schools? Well, you still receive the benefits of the education of others. These are the people that you expect to take care of you in your golden years, so you really don't want them to be, like, uneducated. One of the dreams that we as Americans have is that there will come a time when we can live in retirement and survive. As far as higher education goes, that number that I gave you before is absolutely true. There's not a state in the union that has not seen a significant decrease in the amount of money available for higher education. And it continues to this day. With more people in education, in schools, at every level, and less money to spend per student, which has never been great, in most, not all, but most educational districts, higher education and public education, public higher education, has been taking a hit in every budget since about 1984. And there have been some increases incrementally one year, decreases more than the increase from previous years and future years. Teachers have been affected in several ways, not only the ability to provide quality education to their students because of reduced budgets, but also attacks on the employment security of teachers through attacks on tenure, attacks on teacher unions that provide certain guaranteed benefits for the purpose of teachers, health insurance, for instance. Retirement benefits, pension funds have all been raided. And several unions have gone down because of this. Therefore, teachers and professional educators and administrators have lost the benefits of their work. And there have been organizations established to make sure that that happens, from hiring teachers that work minimum wage without benefits to private education resources that determine what benefits, if any, their subcontract employees, which are not like, you know, employees at the plant. Those are people that sign contracts that say, I'll be your employee for a year, but you can fire me anytime you want to for any cause, to privately held charter schools that are run primarily by three organizations, to magnet schools that have to close because that's an unnecessary luxury in most educational systems where they cannot afford basic education coverage. Money is a big player in education. And there's a lot of big money involved in the education battle. It is in the best interests of a certain percentage of the population if they pay individuals or individual companies to provide what's called education for their kids. These can be charter schools, magnet schools, homeschools, non-public education schools from pre-K through post-grad. There are public in the sense of it's available to everybody. Online educational experiences, which are taking off like wildfire. And they're providing specialty education, topical education, general education. You can learn subjects as simple or as remedial as English and math and the basic sciences, health, environmental studies, anything you want for free. You can get an overview education just for your own purposes. There are a lot of online schools that do not provide certification or CEUs or degrees or diplomas, but they will provide certificates of participation or completion with honors or that sort of stuff. And there are online schools that do offer degree programs. They generally are attached to universities, public universities, private universities, and it becomes another access point for their enrolled students to participate in courses that do count for degree programs. And there's not many universities that don't. And this has all happened in the last 10 years. I teach courses for a couple of universities that have online presence. Those students do receive grades, who do receive credits. And whether you are a full-time student at that university or you enroll only in the online aspect of that university, you pay for that education. You don't get those for free. If you're going to get credit for something, you're going to pay for it. The question is, how much do you pay? In most cases, non-public education costs, on average, 10 times what public education costs. Unfortunately, at the considerations of higher education, that difference can be even greater. Because brick-and-mortar institutions that offer postgraduate information programs, educational programs, require, for the greater part, the student through their tuition to provide all the things that are necessary for that education to take place. That includes housing, that includes meals, that includes all the aspects away from the classroom, as well as the classroom time. So as the cost of energy go up, as the cost of fuel oil goes up, as the cost of, you know, the regular cost of keeping the lights on go up, the student tuition goes up. And they have assorted fees that they have to pay. In most places, you're required to receive, have insurance. So they have student insurance programs that you must pay for. Private education, parochial education through postgrad gets ridiculously expensive. If you are, say, at or below the poverty line, as approaching one half of our population is, we are also a population which is seeing a new growth spike in births. So the decisions we make today are going to affect children for the next 20 years, and that's going to be a rolling cycle. So when we look at the education battle, we have to look a little bit at the long term and see the target as being our grandchildren. And the question is, what education do we want our grandchildren to have? Do we want them to have anything that is possible? Do we want them to have what they can settle for? Do we want them to say, I can't afford education? Is there anything sadder in the world than a student who cannot afford to go to school? I don't know of any. There are so many deaths that take place in that moment. Some kids know from history, you know, that, for instance, nobody in their family has ever gone to college because of the cost of going to college. Some students have been in college, had to leave college and go home. Some students are admitted to Ivy League schools. They have to go to state college because they can't afford Ivy League schools. They apply for scholarships and grants, which is in an extremely diminished capacity these days as opposed to what it was. Even military service does not guarantee a complete education. It helps you pay for it, but there are still a lot of charges you have to have, which means that when you get out of the educational venue of the military, you can take those vouchers or those benefits and you can go apply at school. And if you are not able to reside on campus because of your life condition or your situation, you're married, you got kids, you're not 18, then you've got all those additional charges on top of your education that you have to pay for, and you can't concentrate on learning. That's no different than it is for a child who moves from one school district to the other. Many of the requirements and the changes in the social environment and the family environment when you move to a different place for whatever reason can be even within the same school in the same district if you were forced to leave your home, live in an apartment, or somewhere else. And in those moments, it begins to get really critically important about how you spend your dollars. And all of a sudden, education becomes a luxury. And it's a luxury that many families cannot afford. I would submit to you that to a very large degree, that is on purpose. It's not on purpose by the family. It's on purpose by the educational facilities. First of all, the cost of education is high. Now, I know that my dad worked full-time the entire time he was on a full-ride scholarship to the university. I know that my mother worked full-time. She was on scholarship to her university. I worked full-time, and I was on a full scholarship to my university. So at least we have that in the family trait to contend with. But for us, it was the love of learning and the understanding of the importance and the innate value that an education provided. And I was able to provide some years of significant income production because of my education. And I became more aware of my world. I became more aware of my status. I became more aware of my situation. I became more aware of my responsibilities to the world as a citizen, where I live from the, you know, I always say from the courthouse to the state house to the halls of Congress and even the White House. Now we expand beyond that to an international understanding of how we exist as part of the jigsaw puzzle of a global community. The requirements for participation at that level have gotten more expensive. Whether or not we should be involved is an issue for another show. But the question is, if you have the desire and passion to learn, should you be withheld from learning because of the price? There are those that say, yes, you should, because education is not a right, a privilege. Well, I disagree. And I disagree for several reasons. The first reason, that an education population makes the entire nation better. It's where we get our scientists, our engineers, our doctors, our teachers, our lawyers, our nurses, you know, what they call the professional skills. It's also where we get the best trade craftsmen, the best writers, the best researchers, the best design engineers, the best of everything. And if our nation can provide a steady stream, we can lead the world in education as we have done in the past. We do not do so today. As far as education worldwide rankings, we currently rank 24th. That's quite a fall. And I would submit that anyone who says that education funds need to be cut or the Department of Education needs to be eliminated is not having a fair and decent long view of what America will suffer as a result of that decision. That begins with a local pre-K school, goes all the way to the post-grad school. It goes to the Department of Education, who provides funds for millions upon millions of students to even participate in education, even those who have to repay loans later. I was not the first student in my family to go to college. I was the last one. And it was not an expectation of my parents. It was a choice that I made. And It's hard to say, but I will go so far as to admit I am an educated man, which means nothing. That and a cup of coffee is both worth about $1.98. But it's potential. There have been times in my life when I've heard a lament from people that care about me, "You have such potential. Why are you doing this?" Because it extends my potential. It makes what I know usable. An education is not worth anything if it doesn't have a direct impact on your daily living. It's really neat to know about the Battle of Hastings. Okay? That's a fun thing to look at and to go, "Wow, I didn't know that." Understanding how to program a computer is not just neat to know, but an ever-growing reality is that it's need to know. That's one of the burgeoning industries in the world today is information technology. As a basic, just a basic rule of thumb, there are on average 25,000 new needs identified for computer programming each year. About 25 of those will be addressed with solutions brought to market. Think about that. Services industries are the ones that are growing as we are compelled and forced to move in a large degree away from a manufacturing base to a service information base. I personally am in favor of returning manufacturing to its rightful position in America. We are still the largest consumer nation in the world. We're closely followed by China, then India, then Japan, then Russia. And there are some moves afoot to even further restrict that reality. Now, we'll talk about that at the end of this show with a very special edition on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But the battle of education is one that every family feels. States are creating alternatives to education and then demanding that their citizens participate in that alternative. There are communities that have eliminated public education in favor of for-profit charter schools. Now, the one thing I would like to tell you today is that the most recent reports for the success of charter schools in America is abysmal. The national average failure rate for charter schools in America today is 89%. There has never been a public school that had 89% failure rate 2 years in a row. Charter schools have a 5-year history. But you're paying 10 times as much, and the federal government is helping you do that. You're wasting your own tax dollars if you get 89% failure rate. As an educator, as an education administrator, and as an education enterprise owner, as an educational writer and author, one who has been involved in the education process literally all my life, and certainly from the teaching perspective from 1971 on, when I was privately teaching others, to my graduation from college, to the graduation from college, to do that 5 more times, and to create an educational enterprise that has lasted since 1985, I know what I'm talking about. I have an opinion. Yours may differ, and that's fine. But I want you to know that I'm not coming to this as Johnny Come Lately with no idea of what's going on. I'm in the private education sector. I'm not in the public education. Well, I guess I am, because one of the opportunities that you have is an online situation, but I know that one too. I've built an online enterprise for education, and I've gathered some of the best, finest instructors in the world to that enterprise. I say that not to not to tout the enterprise, but to let you know that I do have some history with what I'm talking about. I have experience, I have education, I have passion, and it is difficult to compete, so I don't. I create a situation where competition will not come because they fear it. My educational opportunities are universally cheaper than they are on other opportunities, public or private. They come with a lifetime guarantee. Because I believe that your education should sustain you throughout your life. And you should sustain the love of learning throughout your life. So there are programs from beginning kids to grandmas. Adult learning is the fastest segment of the population in America today. They are competing with private brick-and-mortar institutions, online institutions, charter schools, magnet schools, all kinds of schools, as those with a lot of money are putting a lot of dollars into a lot of advertising that is negative toward education generally and public education specifically. Over the course of this series, we're going to learn that most of what you hear from those folks is absolute bull. It's not true. It's a lie. How do we better public education in America? We start by funding it. We start by making it a desire of the very best of our students to teach, to help them instill, encourage, and ignite their passion for not only learning, but for sharing what they know with others. And there's a big argument going on about that right now. One of the seeming intended consequences of offshoring so many jobs that 65,000 American factories are shuttered today is that we would not need skilled labor anymore. And skilled labor becomes skilled because of the education required to perform the tasks it requires. Everything from welders to x-ray techs to nurses, they're just not necessary anymore. There's such a shortage of nurses that in many states, if you have a nursing degree, you cannot receive unemployment benefits. Because if you're not working, it's because you don't want to. Further, the reality is that if you have a nursing degree, you can earn a very good salary with benefits. Now, private medical groups, they're a different issue. Public hospitals are another issue. Private hospitals are yet another issue. But I will tell you in all honesty, one of the places that most degreed nurses would never go is into nursing education. They're not paid enough. There are a lot of things they could do rather than teaching in a nursing school environment that would pay them more money for less time with better benefits. So one of the alternatives to education has become, well, public education isn't going to provide you with the security that you need, so why don't you come with us? We won't provide you the security, but we'll pay you a better salary as long as you do what we say. Even if that involves malpractice of medicine, doesn't matter. And that's the other issue. What education is valid? The lines have become blurred. They have been struck by an eraser of money. Because you go to Harvard or Yale or MIT or Stanford, an Ivy League school, a high prestige school, a high institution school, a high tuition school, does not mean that you necessarily receive an equivalent education to the tuition. There are schools that recognize that having their name at the bottom of your resume is in, you're buying that. That's what you're buying. You're buying the legitimacy or the authenticity that a particular school might hold. Even D's pass. And you can get a degree with nothing but D's. Because D is not failing. It's pass. Low pass, but it's pass. And I've known people to go through an entire college education never receiving a grade higher than C, who then have the document with the name at the bottom of their resume that says, I went here, and all of a sudden they're somehow compelled to be propelled into the upper management ranks of a company not having the ability to read. That's the truth. That's experience. And they cannot perform their specialty. That, too, is personal experience. You have to understand that this is why there is a battle for education. As you separate one entity from the other, it's always been said that you have to have an undergraduate degree to attend law school. And you have to be fairly successful in that degree program. In fact, there are schools which tell you that in order to go to a particular post-grad school, you really need to have a degree or at least an emphasis in major or minor in certain subjects, like English. It always blew my mind when I first looked at law school that there were two very distinct subjects they wanted you to participate in. They would really like it if you majored in one and minored in the other. They really didn't care which way that happened. But it was political science and English. But then I thought, you know, lawyers are wordsmiths. They get paid by the word. And, of course, there's a lot of lawyers who take that to insane limits. But that's because they're very cognizant of the billing rate. They may work for major corporations that keep them or promote them based upon their billing rate. And it's terribly difficult to argue when you pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for a law school education and are, because you have your name at the bottom of that page on that school, you're automatically qualified into some firms but not others. It's no different for doctors or anybody else for that matter. It's a very simple reality that in order to make that work, you have to do something. And you have to pay something. Now, there are a lot of creative ways to provide an education for yourself. Okay? One of the things you have to do in order to do that is you have to get around the battle for education. You're not going to be able to do that unless you can clearly identify who the sides of the battle of education are, line up with the side that matters most to you, and go for it. Now, normally there are people who say, I want to be, they don't say I want to be an attorney or an accountant. They say I want to be a partner with A, B, and C LLC, or We Count 'em Beans LLC. Their target is to the job, not to the education. And that becomes difficult for a lot of folks. I know that I am a good enough fill in the blank that I could be associated with fill in the group or the leading company in your field if I had a piece of paper signed by somebody at fill in the institution. That blows state colleges, junior colleges, vocational programs, trade schools, all that stuff right out the window. You go to one of those and get that piece of paper and have that job. That doesn't mean that having the piece of paper, you understand, will get you that job. It just means that you can't even apply for that job without that piece of paper. In some degree, that's been true for a very long time. Okay? But, for instance, when Henry Ford started looking for engineers to build a product that had never existed before, using a process that had never existed before, he didn't look for graduates from one school over another. He asked just one question. And those interviewees who did not answer the question correctly were not hired, regardless of their school, regardless of their experience, regardless of their training, because none of it would apply here. Everything was clean screen. It was fresh. It was never done before. And it included the automated assembly line. It included the V8 engine. It included brakes. It included what would become known as a motor carriage. And he refused to employ people who did not have the same passion for what he was doing, because he knew that those who were passionate were the ones who were going to come up with a solution to the challenges that he was putting before them. And if they couldn't be passionate about the possibilities of success, he didn't want them around him. And some of the people that he hired were not from schools that had that name on the bottom line. In fact, some of the people he hired didn't have a name at the bottom of the line on their resume. They had experience. And it wasn't experience in the automotive industry because it didn't exist yet. They were farriers, you know. They were people who had dedicated years of work with an ethic that was provable. They always showed up on time. They always did the job expected in a high degree of quality. Those were the people that he talked to. The question was, did they have the ability to see the dream? And among the many applicants, he had 99 out of 100 of them said it can't be done. He said, thank you very much. Goodbye. They would go on for days about why it couldn't be done. He wouldn't listen to them. After a very short amount of time, he did not give anybody more than a 5-minute interview. And I would say that over the course of history, that proved to be a fairly reliable way to be successful in the automotive industry with Henry Ford. He wasn't always successful. He had some unknown phenomenal bombs. He had a few that were known. The Edsel comes to mind. Of course, Edsel has always taken it on the chin. But some of the innovations that vehicle created that had never existed before are standard equipment in every vehicle in America today. We don't know that. We don't hear it. I think of the guy that was sitting in a bare bulb office in the back corner of Minnesota Mines and Minerals, who was trying to find one substance and found another. He was trying to find an adhesive that was strong enough to hold a certain weight, would allow that weight to be separated. And what he created was the Post-it note. Because he worked for Minnesota Mines and Minerals, 3M, he didn't get the patent on that. He didn't get paid royalties on it. He got it because he was employed by 3M. He got to keep his job. Same story goes for any number of people who have expanded their passion into reality. The lady, the grandmother who invented Velcro. The three guys who came together, one of whom was my stepbrother, to create Kevlar. these innovations are happening around us all the time. In case you haven't noticed, we have a vehicle on the planet Mars. We're preparing to send another one. Another vehicle just left to do a multi-year exploration of the environment around Mars. Mars. We have people who are working on energy resources to provide needed energy production in this country and other countries, to provide alternate means of energy. We have people who are fighting daily to provide food to the people of this country who need it. We're not doing so well on jobs. We're going to change that shortly, I have a feeling. But we've had to be patient, and in the middle of the patience, we've paid a dear price. We've even paid an unnecessary price. Remember that a lot of the things you use in your home today were not available until NASA appeared on the scene. And that there are innovations that were created by NASA that are in every home in America today. You don't even know it. It's not important. It's not necessary that you know it. But there's a battle on education to restrict those who could be those engineers, those dreamers, those imaginative people who create the solutions we so desperately need for the planet, for our world, for our environment, for our soil, for our water, for our air, for our fuel, for our education, for our social justice, for our criminal justice systems. The people that are in the first grade today will be those people in a generation. Not only that, there's going to be a bunch of them. We are extracting ourselves from over 10 years of war, and there's a new baby boom going on. That's one of the reasons people are arguing so much about Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and health care. We're not looking at the people we have to cover today who don't have it. We've also got to look at the people a generation from now who are going to need it. We have the answers. We don't have the will. We don't have the political will, which is where these changes take place. The reason we don't have the political will is because our citizens remain silent. It is the hope of this program that through the conversation, through the communication, through the dialogue, we can give you information that will take you down a road. We're not going to feed you. We're not going to open up your brain and pour facts into it. We're going to show you that there are places where you can get the information you need to make a difference. This show always asks just one question. What are you going to do about it?